Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, February 16, 2011. It is now 7:01 p.m. Central Standard Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now, before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call toll-free 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. You can also call direct 646-652-4620. Your comments can be sent via email to comments@libertytalkradio.com. This evening, folks, we're pleased to have as our guest Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates. He's returning probably for the fourth time. We have the third Wednesday of every month. There's an update on economic issues. This evening, Andy will discuss silver backwardization, the food crisis, interest rates, jobs, and all that other good stuff. And he will answer any of your questions. So please call in with any of those questions. They don't have to be related to those subjects whatsoever. Remember, the number is 888-773-4496, and I believe we have him on the phone. Good evening. Is that you, Andy?
Joey, how you doing?
Okay. Andy, it seems like you are on this program about twice a week.
The time flies, doesn't it?
You know what? It's getting faster and faster as I get older and older, and it's really starting to bug me.
Well, I tell you, good to hear your voice, my friend. It's
And thank you so much for being our guest once again. It's our privilege to have you on the program. We are pleased that you are here. And we do hope that this evening we do have a couple of good questions, people calling in. We hope. Sometimes we do, and sometimes they surprise us and they stay silent. Well, Andy, I know there were several things. There's nothing going on in the world, so I don't know what the heck we're going to talk about.
No, I know. It's boring right now.
We'll have to make things up. You know, there is so much. Where do you think, what do you think is the very top priority concern that we should have right now?
Well, that's a good question. There's so many things going on out there.
I know that.
I think probably the biggest thing that we have pressing us right now is this whole situation with quantitative easing and the dislocations and the damage that's doing to markets. It's not just here around the world.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago, Bernanke had his Thursday news conference, and I forget who it was, but somebody kind of got after him a little bit and said, hey, you know, there's a lot of people around the world that are alleging that this QE that you guys are doing is causing all these run-ups in food prices, and, you know, that obviously leads to social unrest. I mean, you've got social unrest in a half dozen countries right now.
Right.
A good contributor of that unrest is high food prices. You know, what's your response to that? And Bernanke said basically that, you know, we ought to be happy because, you know, if it wasn't for QE, you know, U.S. markets would be in the toilet. So I think that goes a long way to telling us things that we already knew, but confirming
right.
that, you know, they are active, they are levitating the markets, they are doing damage. And not only are they damaging the currency, they're damaging financial markets, which, you know, that's an obvious one, but they're also damaging some of these commodity markets, and it's leading to situations where people that already spend 30, 40, maybe 50% of their money on food, that's getting a lot worse, and this is having a real humanitarian effect as well now, and this is something that obviously doesn't really bother Ben too much because, you know, they're just going to continue to buy bonds and things like that. And I'm going to be honest with you, Joe, there's one thing that really frosts me about this whole bond purchase program, and I don't think a lot of people are thinking of it this way, but let's go through the mechanics of how this works and then you'll see why am I right about this.
Okay.
When the Fed buys bonds, they buy U.S. government bonds, agency bonds, whatever. But I'm more interested in the U.S. government bonds right now. First, we have to pay interest to the Fed for the privilege of using their money to keep our economy liquid, which is a joke in and of itself.
Because it's our money.
Yeah, that was Congress's responsibility, as was delegated by the Constitution.
Right.
But it gets even worse. When they buy our bonds, the U.S. Treasury is paying the Federal Reserve interest payments. Those interest payments are coming from you. They're coming from me. They're coming from every person that's listening to this show or who will ever listen to this show, our kids, our grandkids, to an unconstitutional, and I'm not going to mince words, a criminal establishment.
Right. No,
that's
agree.
What really gets me torqued about this, because this is totally, totally unfathomable, really, when you think about it. But that's exactly what's happening.
Well, you know what I don't understand? If we are borrowing money from the Fed and they are charging interest on that money, how could we possibly ever pay them back? Because in order to pay them back, we need to borrow more money from them. I mean, there's no end game to that, is there?
You know, they threw Bernie Madoff in jail for running a Ponzi scheme, and that's exactly what the Federal Reserve has been doing for the better part of the last century. When that first dollar went to the Fed and they gave it to, you know, they issued it to the Treasury, it came at interest. There was no way to pay it back without borrowing another dollar.
That's right, yeah.
So forth down the line.
Right.
And that's the very function of how these things work, and that's why we're having so many problems, and that's why they spiral hyperbolically out of control.
You know, my wife asked me a question, and I thought I knew the answer to it, but I did not. So I'm going to ask you. She said, what difference does it make if the Fed buys the bond or China buys the bond?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, we don't know. You know, see, the thing is, that the guys on CNBC, I forget what the gal's name was, she basically said that it's okay if the Fed buys the bond because we're borrowing it from ourselves,
right?
Which was a bald-faced lie. She was basically saying that we should just continue to try to sell them to the Chinese. That really isn't any better, because whoever owns your debt owns you.
That's correct.
So do we want to be owned by the Fed and its surrogates, or do we want to be owned by the Chinese?
I picked the Chinese. You know, I think we have a better chance with them.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm starting to think maybe you might be right. But that's really what it comes down to. Whoever you owe money to, that's who owns you.
Yeah. But,
you know,
but
it's not just the Chinese. We owe the Japanese, the Canadians. The Canadians actually snuck up onto the list.
Yeah.
You know, everybody talks about Canada and how great a jurisdiction Canada is and how smart they are fiscally. Well, we owe them, too. They're buying some of this junk, too. So, you know, this is a situation where, you know, we owe so many different people. And those people own us to varying degrees.
Right. Well,
the Fed seems to want to get in and compete with China now. So, not good. None of this is good.
Oh, no, I don't know why it's not good. I just know instinctively it's not good. But it makes no difference who buys the bond. The end result is the same. You're creating money out of debt. There really is no difference between China buying the debt or the Fed buying the debt, because they're both independent entities, if you will. Is that true? Or do I have that wrong?
Yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, the thing that makes it kind of double-dipping by the Fed is that we had to buy the money from them to begin with. We had to borrow it.
Yeah.
Just to get it into circulation. And then when they print more of it and, you know, they buy U.S. government bonds, they're kind of double-dipping a little bit in a lot of cases.
Okay.
You know, the money that they already had, that we had paid back in interest, they used to buy government bonds, so they're double-dipping with that money. You know what I mean?
Oh, boy.
So they collected interest when they lent it out to us to use to keep our economy going, and then they double-dip when they buy government bonds, and now they're collecting more interest. Now, these new fresh dollars that they're printing out of thin air and just going and directly buying government bonds with them, you know, they're only single-dipping on those. But, you know, I don't know. The problem is, instead of trying to figure out, you know, what we should be doing about all of this, we should be saying, all right, the government is on a diet. And, you know, you hear a lot of token talk about that, but I don't see anybody really coming out with anything that's going to be substantial. You know, Obama here was on TV yesterday. He's saying we're going to balance the budget. And how's he going to balance it with $1.5 trillion deficits? I mean,
right.
The guy must have flunked second grade math.
Right. Well,
you know, I don't understand it.
Well, when,
how they propose to do this.
Well, when the Fed says that they are going to buy out bonds and monetize the debt, what is the difference between the Fed monetizing the debt or China buying the bond and us issuing the money? Or is that money that's already been issued where China buys the debt? See, that's where I'm confused. I don't know the difference between the two. I don't know the effective difference between
the
two.
Yeah, see, the Chinese can't monetize their debt because they don't print dollars.
Right.
They can buy money that already exists. Yeah, not buy. They can use money, I'm sorry, that already exists in the system to buy the bonds, where the Fed just prints it from nothing.
Okay, all right. So that's additional money when the Fed buys out
right.
bonds. Okay,
There's a small distinction there, but yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, my wife always throws these questions at me, and they sound so simple, but I very rarely can answer them. That's just as great. It keeps me on my toes. Your latest newsletter talks about the employment figures. You know, everything seems to be getting so much better. You know, housing starts are up, you know, business, you know, you name the indicator, it's up. In fact, even with the American Institute of Economic Research, for the past several months, most of the economic indicators, over 90%, both the lagging, the and leading indicators, all are in the 90-plus category. They're up very, very slightly, but up a little bit. Then when you hear some of the employment figures and other current issues, it seems like the economy is getting better. Why isn't that so?
Well, I mean, really what you've got is you have isolated situations. I'll use the housing market as an example because that was one of the underpinnings of the pre-crisis economy. There was just a piece at the end of January that actually appeared in mainstream news that stated it's, the numbers came from, let me just look at it here, Realty Track, and they're saying that 11% of homes in the United States right now are sitting empty.
Right, yeah.
And that's obviously a very high number.
Right.
We're still building more. I mean, this makes no sense. You see what I'm saying? So we look at housing numbers and we say, okay, well, new housing starts went up, you know, X percent or however many houses and however many permits or whatever, that went up. That's a good thing. Well, how is it a good thing when we already have, you know, over 10% of the houses that already exist are sitting empty?
Right. Well, from what I understand,
how is building more a good thing? I mean, that's you have to. It's one of those things. You know, if you're just casually looking at this stuff, you can't.
Well,
you can't look at it and take it at face value because there's always more than what they tell you, and that's a good example.
Well, I heard
another one.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, what I did hear is that many of the houses that are for sale are in neighborhoods where there are many houses for sale and the values are going down, so people can't sell houses. The houses that they're building very selectively in certain places where that situation doesn't exist, so they can stand a better chance of selling the house. So they have literally given up on the – now, this is what I've heard on, I think, NPR radio – they've given up on trying to sell the house, you know, in the older neighborhood, in the established neighborhood, and betting that they can sell the house, you know, in the newer neighborhood where, you know, there isn't already rot setting in. And I don't know how true that is.
Well, I'll point to another piece that came out, and it talks about how housing prices in areas that people would never have imagined there to be a price issue with housing. They never thought this crash would get to these areas because they didn't see so much of the boom. You know, it wasn't like a California or a Florida or a Michigan or Arizona or one of these places. They didn't see a boom, and they're still getting hit. So, you know, my question to the home builders is, where exactly are you building houses, and how do you purport to be able to sell them when the entire recovery that you're basing your whole business model on is phony? It's being created by deficit spending, printed cash, and we know in the long run none of that's sustainable.
Right.
But the answer lies in the fact that all of these home builders now, you know, at least the big ones, are publicly traded companies. They can't just stop building.
Right.
You know,
that's
if these
true.
Guys just stop building houses, the shareholders are going to riot. The stock
right.
prices are going to crater and all this good stuff, and they just can't have that.
Right.
You know, they're obligated by law to try to increase shareholder value, and they can't do that by saying, we're going to take a year hiatus and, you know, let the market work off some of these excesses.
Yeah.
They can't do that, so they have to keep building. So what they're going to do is they're going to find the area that they think they have the best chance, and everybody's
right.
going to race into that area, and they're all going to build houses, and then you know exactly what's going to happen after that.
Now, yeah, these houses haven't been pre-sold, I assume, in many of these cases. I mean, they're speculative, like every other house that's been built.
I think what you're seeing is kind of a secondary real estate bubble that's going on in
yeah.
a lot of these areas. You don't have bubble prices, but you have the bubble mentality, and you know how bubbles end. They end poorly.
Yeah.
And again, it's just, you know, these companies, some of them are starting to wise up, but a lot of them are still basing their business model on Keynesian economics that, hey, it doesn't matter that the government's going to have $1.5 trillion of red ink this year.
Right.
And it doesn't matter that next year's budget is probably going to be $1.5 trillion.
Right.
And it doesn't matter that the national debt's going to be, you know, God knows what in 5 years. That doesn't matter. It's not important. We've always gotten away with it, so we'll always be able to get away with it. That's
right.
the mentality.
Right.
And that's flawed. That's flawed. Look at, you know, everybody says, well, that's Europe. That's not going to happen here because this is America. I've got news for them. You know, that's actually, it will happen here, and it's going to happen worse because we've pushed it further.
Right. All right, Andy,
these things always go back to the mean, and the further away you get from the mean, the further you have to fall to get back to the mean. It's just, those are the laws of economics, and they're immutable. And people who think, well, you know, we have computers now, and we have quantitative, you know, statistical mathematicians on Wall Street with MIT degrees, and they can figure out a way to beat the laws of economics. Wrong answer.
Let's hold that thought and let's pause for station identification.
Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Folks, we're pleased that Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist with Sutton Associates, has agreed to return to our program. Andy will discuss silver backwardization, the food crisis, interest rates, jobs, housing, but he will also answer any of your questions. Please call us toll-free, 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Okay, well, Andy, We had good employment figures back in the earlier part of the decade, and that was primarily because when you build a house, you stimulate all sorts of economic activity. You know, there's everything that goes into a house, everything from porcelain, aluminum, glass, wood, you name it, concrete. When they don't build that house, lots and lots of people go out of business or lose their jobs. No one sees this housing returning to that level in the next even 10, and some say even 20 years. That means those people who had jobs are not going to have jobs, and there's no other jobs to companies to absorb them. So does it look like we're going to have this unemployment situation ad infinitum?
This is one of the things. This is one of the few pieces of honesty that we actually got out of Bernanke a couple of years ago when they started to really push up the markets and work in there. And it was back in 2009. And, you know, I wrote about it, and you and I talked about it. He said, yes, we're going to have a recovery, but don't look for too many jobs. And this is why. And it's not just housing. You know, we've exported so many of our better-paying jobs. And when
right.
you think about it, when you have a guy that's making $50,000 a year, and he can live in a house that's not grossly overvalued, so he's not paying 50% of his take home in mortgage payments. He has money to spread around the economy. And we did. And we spread that money around the economy. We bought vehicles. We bought, you know, kitchen appliances, you know, whatever. And that created job activity for people here in America. And that was the case for a long time. The problem is, once the jobs started going overseas, the people that are still here, they spread their money around. They buy the same things, but the money goes offshore now.
Right.
You know,
right.
if that stove or that color TV is made in Japan or China, that doesn't go to another U.S. worker so he can spread his pay around. It goes to some worker over in the Far East,
right.
and they're going to spread it around their economy.
Right. Right.
So when we exported those jobs, we exported a lot of our nation's wealth because you had less and less people in this country with less and less money to spread around. And so, voila, our fine-feathered friends on Wall Street came out with the credit card. And you will notice, and I do not believe that this is a coincidence at all, if you go to any site and find a chart of when consumer credit outstanding started to really take off in this country, it was right about the time when we were getting into all these trade agreements and we were moving jobs overseas. And that's not an accident. So that had to fill the gap. You know, to be able to spread money around, we didn't have all these people making money around here anymore to be able to do that. So we had to start relying on credit cards, and that went for 7, 8, 10 years maybe, 12, and then the housing, you know, the boom kicked off there. We started pulling money out and refinancing and getting cash back on our refinances, and you know, taking out option arms and reverse amortization mortgages and. You know, doing all those stupid things that got us into trouble a few years ago and are still getting us into trouble. And that filled the gap with even more loss of quality jobs. You know, and if you take a look at a longer-term chart of the number of full-time jobs in this country and the number of part-time jobs, you'll see the part-time jobs going way up and the full-time jobs going way down.
Yeah, right. Now,
and that's just been the way it's gone. And you take a look at our manufacturing sector, yeah, it's rebounded a little bit. Recently, you know, the Europeans are buying jets from Boeing and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's good. We need more of that. We don't have enough of it. You know, instead of, you know, 50,000, you know, manufacturing jobs being added a month, we need 500,000 jobs being added a month. And we're not doing the things that are necessary to stimulate the kind of jobs that we're going to need to make up for this housing situation, which you so accurately pointed out. The ripple effect there. You know, we need to have other economic activity, which is going to spread money around our economy to enable it to function properly. And we relied on housing, and now it's gone. When you have 11% of houses sitting empty, it's going to take a long time to work that down. So these people that are saying 10, 15, 20 years till this gets resolved, and they might be absolutely right. I wouldn't be shocked if it was longer.
Yeah.
So... You know, you make a very good point there, Joe, about, you know, how the ripple effect of what is going on here when we lose that kind of a situation. And we lost it because we pushed it too far. We bubbleized it. And if we'd have just let it go normally and not done all these silly financing deals and mortgages and all this other stuff, we'd probably still have it.
Yeah. Well, you know,
but now we don't.
Why would anyone, any other country be interested in buying out debt? Under the circumstances?
Well, you know, for the longest time, and I think what happened here initially is, you know, back in the 40s, you know, after World War II, I mean, we were in prime shape.
Right.
We were the only country, basically, that didn't have our infrastructure blown to pieces.
Right.
Japan was in a shambles.
Right.
Europe was in a shambles. China wasn't even on the grid at that point as far as being an industrial power.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were the kingpin.
Right.
And over the next 20 years, we squandered it.
Right.
You know, we had the Great Society programs. We did all these things.
The Korean War.
Most people that listen to this show probably know exactly what we did there. We don't need to get into the details. But when we went off gold in 1971, I think we had to make some deals. You know, we can't pay you in gold anymore. We're going to have to issue these bonds. And I think what happened is they sold the country out. They went to places like Japan, they went to places like China, and they said, look, you guys, you know, we can give you a huge consumer market in the United States. We got, you know, 230 or two, whatever it was, million people at the time, and, you know, they have, you know, halfway decent jobs and, You know, there's money available. We will give you that market. We will set up a trade environment that is conducive to you and destructive to U.S. companies if you'll buy these bonds. And I think that was the deal that was made in the back room.
Okay, that makes sense.
Back in the 70s.
Unfortunately, that makes sense.
And then what happened is China used our consumption. They used that, and they used the vendor financing situation that they were running with us to build this huge, massive infrastructural superpower.
Yeah.
And Japan, to a lesser extent, did kind of the same thing. I mean, they've had a lot of problems, but there's no doubt they certainly sold an awful lot of electronics here and cars and other things like that. I think that's what happened.
Yeah, and
I think we were sold out. I really do.
Now, but isn't some of that being reversed? Aren't we now manufacturing more for the emerging markets countries than we had before?
We are. We're taking some things and we're able to sell. One of the biggest exports that we have for these guys is food. And that's obviously another topic that we put on the list, but we can kick that off for later. But we do export quite a bit of food. The problem is now we're starting to import quite a bit too. And recently, we've become a net food importer, which is not really a good thing either, especially when you think about that's the most staple of staple goods. But we do export things. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not sitting here saying, hey, you know, we don't make anything. We do. We've got heavy equipment. We've got Caterpillar. We've got DuPont, Dow Chemical. You know, those are just to name a few. They're industrial companies. They're here in America. I mean, they're multinationals. But, you know, they've got factories here, plants, processing, what have you. We are able to export those things overseas. Obviously, the weaker dollar helps them because it makes our goods more competitive overseas.
Right.
So, you know, the weaker the dollar gets, the more it helps these multinational firms as far as being competitive on foreign shores. So, you know, that's a good thing for them, but it's a lousy thing for the rest of us because we still import most of our consumer goods, so, you know, obviously the U.S. consumer has to pay more for those imports. So, you know, that knife cuts both ways.
Right.
But we do make things here. I think there's a lot of people that do a lot of disservice to the argument by saying, well, we don't make anything. Well, we do. We do make things.
Right.
And, you know, if you look hard, there's certain things you can find that are still made in this country. You know, if you're in Walmart, you're going to have a hard time finding anything and, you know,
right.
that kind of stuff.
We don't make consumer goods.
But
we make some industrial goods, you know. I mean, like airplanes,
you know,
we do make airplanes. Well,
right. If you're in the mood to buy a 747 for Liberty Talk Radio, I mean, you can buy one from Boeing. And,
right.
You can fly me in to do the show in the studio.
Okay, I'll do that. Well, you know, when
the screening to get on the plane.
You know, these government figures, and the more I think about them, the more insane they get. For example, if the government recruits a person to serve in the army and then sends that person overseas, which is a destructive job, not a constructive job, that person gets all of the gets off of the unemployment rolls. Is that true?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I mean, if you have somebody who's marginally attached to the workforce or who's unemployed, you know, especially like a younger person, you know, like 22, 23-year-old kid, and they go and sign up for the armed services, all of a sudden they've got a job.
Yeah, you know, but that drives me nuts because having a job in the military is like manufacturing something, going out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, dropping in and just dropping it to the bottom of the sea and coming back and building another one. There's no value to anyone on that, but it makes the figures look better. But it's, in fact, a negative because that soldier is being paid by general revenues, and then he's going overseas, and he may get himself killed, of course, you know, use ammunition, you know, whatever the case may be. And it almost seems as if any time that we recruit somebody into the military services, we should count that there are two people unemployed. I mean, it should be the reverse. You see
my
logic?
That's a really good point. I mean, there's a lot of situations you can name, and that's probably the best example of jobs that are actually a drain, economically, net on net.
Right.
You know, they don't add anything. They don't produce anything. You know, it's like a casino worker. You know, what does a casino worker produce? Nothing.
Right.
You know, they shuffle a tray of cocktails around and, you know, help people to get whatever, and then they end up spending all of their money.
Right.
And somehow, you know, we're told that this is prosperity. You know, if we can get a casino to come into our area, there's going to be prosperity. How is it? How is that? It's a drain.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, you know, it's another example, you know, of these types of things. You know, what we need in this country, you know, instead of taking this money and blowing it on silly things, we, you know, like a bridge. I mean, yeah, maybe the bridge needs to be replaced, but how is the bridge going to pay for itself? We need to put our money and invest it into things that are going to pay for themselves.
Right.
And eventually make us a profit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a family with a stock account. You know, if you had 50 stocks that you knew were losers, and you knew they were going to be losers, and, you know, you had 100% transparency of information and all that good stuff, and you had another 50 that you knew eventually over time were going to make you money, why would you invest in the 50 losers?
Right.
But that's what we do. We invest in things that don't pay us back. They don't create anything. It's all short-term, and it needs to be constantly fed.
Right.
You know, or if you were to build a factory, you could put, you know, 10,000 guys to work or 5,000 guys to work or whatever, and the factory would make products, and the products could be used domestically. You know, that would cut down on imports. And then if they had excess, we could export the rest, and then we could bring money into the country instead of sending money out. That factory pays for itself over
right.
time. That's a wise investment. And investing it in, you know, this, you know, make jobs and make work stuff, and, you know, we're gonna paint this bridge and, you know, do these kind of silly things. You know, yeah, in a good economy, you know, when the government has a cookie jar of savings, yeah, I mean, that stuff needs to get done. You need to maintain your infrastructure. But when you're in the situation that we're in, you've got to come up with stuff that's going to pay for itself, and then it's got to contribute to the national wealth. And we're just not doing it.
Well, the only
we're not even thinking along those lines.
The only people who can do that are people investing their own money and not government doing it using somebody else's money, because it doesn't make any difference. If I spend your money, believe me, I'm very generous. My own money, I'm really cheap, you know. But, you know, it's the free enterprise system that determines that. But let's hold that thought, and let's stop for station identification once again. Oh, what happened? We lost our sound.
Talk derived from a historical perspective, not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Folks, we're pleased that Andy Sutton, chief strategist with Sutton & Associates, has agreed to return to our program. Andy is discussing, we'll be discussing silver backwardization, the food crisis, interest rates, jobs, but he will also answer any of your questions. Please call us toll-free, 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Of course, at any time, you can send us your email to comments@libertytalkradio.com.
Political talk derived from a historical perspective, not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Well, I just heard on the television. I think I was watching Fox News, which I rarely do, but I was eating a sandwich and I wanted something to do for 5 minutes. That the Chevy Volt is now is not the most economical or the most green car out there, but it is the most expensive. It is selling incredibly. I think they sold like 330 cars or something like that, and it's the most expensive, and it's not the greenest. And the ones that were greener were the Ford. Ford has one. The Ford the Honda Civic GS, which is natural gas car, the Honda, as I said, the Prius, and of course that little smart car, and Nissan has one. I forgot what it's called. Anyway, but they were five cars ahead of the Chevy Volt, and the Chevy Volt was the most expensive of all of them.
You know what? This is going to be an unfair comment, but I'm going to make it anyway. you've got the government running that company. What do you expect?
You know, and they're saying that each Chevy Volt so far has cost the taxpayers $100,000. You know, because they received millions to develop this car. But you know, when are we going to stop this insanity? Everything seems to be. I don't understand anything anymore. I'm getting to the point where I think I'm going to lose my mind because I think that I don't understand it anymore. Either I'm so stupid I can't understand it, or I'm brilliant. And these guys are stupid. I just don't understand it. It just drives me nuts.
I would lean towards the sides of brilliant. I mean, we really are convinced, and there's pockets of areas of the country where this isn't true, but I think representatively, and probably everybody who's listening to this show is not going to fall into this category, but we demand that the government take care of us. We have gotten so lazy as a society. We want to be taken care of, and we want the government to provide jobs. And, you know, I was called a deficit terrorist by a contributor on Fox News that I got into an email debate with, and I was called a deficit terrorist because I said that the government should stop government spending and they should let the private sector create jobs, not have the government try to do it.
Right.
And this, unfortunately, is the way a lot of people think.
Right.
They think that, well, the government does it better than everybody else. Let them take the money from everybody and they can spend it the most efficiently. And we have history, Joe, reams and reams of historical evidence to the contrary, that it doesn't work that way, and it never has.
Yeah.
The private sector, when it's incentivized by the profit motive and free market, all the government's supposed to do is set it up so that the private sector can succeed, create a few regulations to make sure you don't get a bunch of knuckleheads like Lloyd Blankfein and his crew running all over everybody roughshod, and then get out of the way.
Right.
That's basically what the government's supposed to be doing.
Right.
And they failed miserably. They think they can do it better. They can't. And they're going to spend money until they're, I don't know, until oblivion. And they'll probably still believe that they can do it better. And they'll blame, I don't know, guys like you and me or something like that for, you know, not encouraging the public to get on board with it.
Yeah,
I don't know.
We're negative. You know, I was called negative last week, and I said, please, I said, I really am not negative. If I was a negative person, I wouldn't be getting up 5:30 in the morning when I don't have to and hustle all day. Negative people stay home, do nothing. I said, I'm a realist.
Exactly.
And I said, maybe it's time for you to wake up. And I was really mad. Don't call me negative. Am I hacked off? I'm always hacked off. But that's not negative. I can't stand that. Last time we spoke a little bit about inflation versus deflation. Has your opinion on that changed much, or are we about in the same boat as we were last month, in your opinion?
We really haven't changed that much. I mean, we're still on the middle ground there. This could still go either way. I've had conversations with a number of people, and we've put our heads together, and we've argued both sides, and we've made the case for, we've made the case against both sides, and tried to shoot holes at each other and do all these kinds of things. And you know, I spent a couple hours on the phone mulling this whole thing over, and, you know, we're not really any closer to an answer than we were when we started. And there's a lot of factors that are playing into the inflation side, and I think that's what most of the people are seeing. They're seeing these unfunded liabilities. That's becoming propagated, maybe not through the media itself, but through the alternative media, shows like yours. We talk about these things. I did get some updated information on two-period life cycle analysis for the state liabilities. They're about $36 trillion in unfunded liabilities among the 50 states. So, I mean, there's a huge problem there. And that kind of gets back to, you know, this whole thing that's going on in the muni bond market right now. Hey, if somebody wants some good entertainment, and if you were a shareholder, you're not going to be entertained by this, but the bond insurer AMBAC, symbols ABK, go and take a look at that. Look at about 3 years worth of data on ABK.
Okay.
And see what you think that has to say about the municipal bond market. They're a bond insurer. They provide insurance for municipal bonds. So see what conclusion that leads you to, and see if you agree with me that that's the biggest story that's not being told.
Well, you know, people
and
say that.
I really think that's one of them right there.
You know, people say that people who are those economists who are saying that there's a problem with the municipalities and they can file bankruptcy and it's, you know, it causes all sorts of economic problems. They try to debunk that, but I don't understand how they can debunk it because they're all broke. I mean, they're all going the same way, but somehow they think, like everything else, we're going to work it out. This is America. You know, we've been through this before. And no, we haven't been through this before, and this we can't work it out.
Yeah, well, you know, this idea that this is America and somehow that cloaks us in immunity from a good economic beating.
Right.
I mean, that's just not valid. I've heard a couple of people talk, a couple of mainstream commentators mention that the idea that states could get out of these debts and wiggle out of these debts by basically going into federal receivership. And it was interesting, Joe, because in order to make that argument, they had to admit that the states were sovereign.
That's right.
Which really
right.
kind of made me laugh a little bit. Yeah. It's like, okay, so I see the method here. You know, if the states are sovereign and now they go into receivership by the feds, they aren't going to be sovereign anymore for sure.
Right.
How are the feds going to pay for all this? Oh, wait, they'll just get more money from the Federal Reserve. I see. We'll put on the steel-toed shoes this time and we'll kick the can a little bit further down the road. None of this is solving the problem.
Well,
that's the important thing that people need to take. And I really wish somebody would call. Because
yeah,
I
know.
I'm really excited right now.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't know why. You know, surprisingly, I mean, let me say, I was very surprised. We get downloads of our program. We get somewhere in the vicinity, and you can't get exact counts. It's impossible, but somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000
right.
a month. And I tell you, when I saw that figure, it just blew my mind because I think if I get 500, I'm happy, you know? I mean, 6,000 to 10,000.
Right,
I said,
yeah,
wow. But it did show that the number of people calling in was infinitesimal. And I said, I wish some of these people would call in. I mean, they're listening to this program.
Somebody out there that has a question about all of this stuff. You know, and I'm not, first of all, I want to point out, I don't know everything, obviously. And I certainly don't want to come across as though I do. If I don't, I'll admit it, and I know you're the same way, but we like questions.
Oh, yeah. And
we like conversations. So somebody, please call.
Yes, and especially if they disagree. I would prefer, I mean, no use saying, you know,
yeah.
saying something, let's say, calling us, yeah, I agree with you. Well, thank you very much. That's the end of that conversation, you know. But I'd like for people to call in. It's 888-773-4496. Folks, it's a free call. It's toll-free. I'm paying for the call. Please call in with anything, with your grandmother's favorite recipe. I'll take anything at this point. I am desperate for a caller. The other morning I had a 6:30 in the morning. I figured no one would call. I got two callers. One from Tennessee and one from Oregon or something like that. What are these people calling me 6:30
wow.
in the morning for? But you never know when they're going to call.
Back
you
Oregon just don't know. Was up early.
Yeah, I mean, they're just unbelievable. I mean, I don't understand it. The government can't seem to get out of this because if they exercise an austerity program, that means they're going to have to close things down, departments or agencies or whatever. And that's putting people out on the street without an income. That's going to increase the unemployment figures, increase the number of people who are going to be relying maybe on government assistance. It just doesn't seem like there is any way out of this. Am I just negative or what?
Saying that they're between a rock and a hard case.
Yeah.
And the hard case is reality, and I don't know what the rock is. It's a bad example, but yeah, you're exactly right. You know, these government programs, you know, I just read a piece the other day, maybe it was even today, the days kind of run together, that the Health and Human Services Department today is bigger than Eisenhower's entire government. That's just one
yeah,
little department.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, if that doesn't tell people that this is out of control, look where all that money has gone over the last 50 years. Look at all that borrowing. I mean, the national debt has gone parabolic in the last 50 years. I mean, look at a chart. Don't believe me. Go and look at a chart. How much of that do you think went into this big government? A lot of it.
Right.
A lot of it went into this huge, massive, parasitic government that we have now that accomplishes almost nothing. We need, what was it, 80 people in the IRS to enforce this ridiculous tanning salon tax?
Yeah.
Something like that, 80, 180 people to you know, collect taxes from tanning salons. Are you kidding me? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's going on, and that's just one example. There's probably thousands.
But, you know, yes.
It's unreal.
Here in Oklahoma, we have a casino 1 mile from my house. And I bike down there. I motorcycle down there. I take my bike down there. I mean, I pass by. And the parking lots are always jammed. The shopping centers are empty. There's holes all over the place. Stores are closing down all over the place. Unemployment is ratcheting up. And the casino is always jammed.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have them here in Pennsylvania, too, and it's the same kind of thing. You know, we had, you know, I probably talked about this before, and I pardon anybody who has to listen to this story again, but my hometown was the kind of a hometown of Bethlehem Steel, and, you know, that kind of went down the tubes in 1997, and there were still a few little operations going on, but essentially it died in 1997. Well, what sits on that ground now is a casino.
Ah.
And it has these little restaurants called Steel Garden, and, you know, I don't know, they named like all the stores and all the shops and all the nonsense that's down there after like these Bethlehem Steel themes. And it really ticks me off, because that was something at its, you know, time when it actually contributed to the economy.
Right.
It employed people. It produced things. The things were sold overseas. It brought money into the country. What does a casino do? It's a big toilet plunger on the local economy.
Right.
It sucks away money. Everybody's been promised tax relief here. I don't know if they did that down your way.
Oh, yeah,
and
we got no tax
nobody's
relief.
Nobody's gotten a dime in tax relief. But, you know, the casinos are certainly making lots of money. What a racket. I mean, what a sham.
In your newsletter, you talked about the Saudi lie. How is that going to affect, you know, the price of gasoline, do you think? You know, with the reserves that Saudi says that they have, and, you know, they say that they have and what they may have, and what their production capabilities may be.
You know, a lot of people have been speculating that, you know, geologists, industry analysts for years now, that Saudi Arabia and the other OPEC members were overstating reserves, because basically their production quotas were dictated by the amount of reserves they had.
Right.
So it was amazing. You know, these guys would pump, you know, 9-10 million barrels a day in the case of Saudi Arabia, and their reserves never went down.
Right.
So they always kept pumping. And here, a couple of cables were released a few weeks ago between the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh and the State Department here in Washington, D.C., and they were talking to some geologists for the state oil company over there, Saudi Aramco, and basically they said, these numbers are probably overstated by 40%. And, you know, everybody was worried, you know, depending on Saudi Arabia to be able to pump enough oil to keep a lid on prices, and they'd have to go to 12.5 million barrels a day. And, you know, these guys who were geologists were saying, not going to happen. You know, maybe 10, maybe 10 and a half, maybe in 20 years they can get to 12, but they're not going to be able to keep a lid on prices. And we were depending on Saudi Arabia to be able to keep a lid on prices. And, you know, that genie is kind of out of the bottle now.
Right.
So what effect that has on oil markets, it hasn't really done a lot here in the United States, but Brent crude is over $100 a barrel. It was up to 103 the last time I checked it. Our oil here is still hovering around $90 a barrel. You know, and that is another problem, because, you know, anytime you get really above 75 for a sustained period of time, it starts to cut into the economy.
Right.
You know, and there's very little recovery to begin with. And what's there was basically engineered by stimulus packages,
right.
Federal Reserve rescue programs, you know, and other types of Keynesian nonsense. And that's even going to be inhibited by high gasoline prices. You know, we're over $3 here. Most areas are very close to $3. There's a lot of analysts that are calling for $4, you know, for summer. That's going to take a chunk out of the economy. It's going to make it harder for anybody who is managing to keep their head above water. It's going to make it harder for them to do so. So I think this is a big deal. It's, you know, again, it's another one of these things that our U.S. media really hasn't talked about. You know, and I'm starting to feel, Joe, like my sensible investor is turning into a newspaper more than anything else. Because I'm talking about these things and I'm not hearing them really anywhere else.
Right.
I mean, there's, you know, the guys that think like we do, you know, they'll talk about it, but you're not going to turn on the mainstream and hear about any of this stuff.
That's right.
You know, I never fancied myself as a journalist, but, you know, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's my calling here.
But the sensible investor will be on all your newsstands from now on. Hold on.
I hope not. No.
We have a caller. I think I know who it is. Caller, you're on the air. Is that Jim?
Is it our buddy Jim? And yes, it is.
Andy, how are you guys this evening?
How's it going? I knew you were going to call.
Well, you know, I'm glad you had more confidence than I did. My wife and I were out to dinner and just got back a few minutes ago. So I'll have to listen to the first 45 minutes on loop, you know, recorded. But
we begged and pleaded about 10 minutes ago.
what for me to call, Jim?
Somebody to call, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I apologize if you've touched on this already. I know you were talking about a little bit, I think, about the unrest in the Middle East and how that affect oil prices. I'll just ask you a very just open-ended question. Both the Obama administration and then the GOP submitted their budget proposal, and then the GOP's gave kind of a response and their counteroffer. And, of course, it got a lot of attention on the media, mainstream media, NPR, talking about this, that, and the other. And just one, what's through all the noise, how do you feel about the budget proposal of the administration and the GOP's response? And I'll take your question off the air, and again, look forward to listening to the show recorded, and look forward to hearing from you again, Andy. Thanks.
Hey, good enough. It's good hearing from you. Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thank you, Jim.
Joe, you should probably hit this too, because this is more your area of study than mine, but what I'll say is not enough and too much.
Yeah.
There's not enough cuts being proposed, and the spending is way too much.
Right.
That's my opinion in a nutshell on it. We need a total makeover. And, yeah, it's going to cost jobs. We need to get these people out of the public sector and create an environment where there's a suitable, sustainable private sector where they can find productive employment, doing things that will pay for themselves and bring money back into the country. And that's my quick opinion on that.
Yeah. Well, if you're asking for my opinion, I'll give it to you, and it'll be very short. We need to have a crash. Just like we needed General Motors to go bankrupt, and they needed to just dissolve themselves of all the unproductive garbage, all the contracts that they had, everything. Someone would come in, buy them out, or whatever, reinvest into it, or they would come under a certain chapter of the bankruptcy court and start from new, start anew. The only way that we can eventually get this under control is if we have a monumental crash. Because what we need to do is, number one, dismantle the entire empire, save $1 trillion a year. If we dismantle the empire, then we won't have to worry about the war on terror, because people won't be terrorizing us, because we won't be terrorizing them. And it'll be tit for tat, and it'll be fine. But this would put so many people out of a job that our unemployment rate would skyrocket. People would probably take to the streets, because they won't be enough money to feed families. And that's what I mean. We would have a monumental crash, and then we can build from there. For example, the first thing you do is you dismantle the entire empire and you go back to just having a Department of Defense cost about 1/20th of what we're spending now. Get rid of all the stupid aircraft carriers, all the stupid garbage. Then things like Medicare. Yes, you can change Medicare, but all you need to do is say, you know, Medicare should be like your auto insurance. You have auto insurance in case someone hits you and you got this gigantic bill on your hands and your car is wrecked and whatever, and then they'll pay for it. But when you go in and change your oil, the insurance company doesn't pay for it. When I'm on Medicare
exactly.
Now, if I go to the doctor and I go for my checkup, the guy charges me $35, I pay. If he charges me more than $35, I find another doctor. Very simple, you know? In other words, we put competition back into the healthcare system by treating it like auto insurance. And people have to start participating in their own health care. Now, obviously, if they have a heart attack, God forbid, cancer, or whatever, you know, then, you know, Medicare kicks in, you know, 100%. And just doing those two things would save well over $1 trillion a year, and you can do that effective now. But that's my opinion.
Well, you know,
what do I know?
The thing about that is, you know, and I'm going to expound on that because probably a lot of people, you know, their gut reaction would be, I can't afford to pay for my health care. Guess what? If we had a situation where we dismantled this governmental empire and put factories back into America, and this takes time, don't get me wrong, there's going to be pain here.
Yeah.
If you did those things, you would have an economy that produced jobs that were quality jobs, and people would be able to pay for these things.
Right, right.
It would be back like it was in the 1950s. You know, you didn't have rampant poverty in the 50s. You know, you didn't have extravagance. You had, you know, basic, simple, sustainable living.
That's right.
And there's no reason we can't get back to that. We got away from it because the government got involved.
That's right.
They were going to do it better, and they were going to do it for everybody, and they were going to be the nanny. And the Federal Reserve was the willing co-conspirator in this, and that they were more than willing to supply all the money that the federal government needed to undertake this nonsense.
Right. Yeah, we have to get rid of the Federal Reserve,
you know,
get rid of all this stuff.
Before they recruited the Chinese and the Japanese into it, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, I mean, you get rid of the DEA, you get rid of the education administration, get rid of all that garbage, all that big administrative garbage that does nothing. In fact, get the government out of school systems altogether, everything.
Anyway.
Yeah, but that would require such a monumental crash where we have nothing and we'd have to rebuild from scratch. And that's the only way out. What we're doing now is we're chipping away at the periphery and we're saying, well, in 3 years, we can save $20 million if we do. I mean, it's some insignificant amount of money. In fact, the money that they are talking about right now saving, by the time they finish discussing it, we rack that up in our national debt.
Oh, easily.
You know, so, I mean, it's no way. Well, that's my opinion. One last thing. Silver backwardization. You have got to explain that to our listeners.
Well, basically, backwardation is a situation where normally what happens is, you know, I'm talking about futures contracts. Normally what you have is a contango where current silver doesn't cost as much as silver down the road because you have storage costs and insurance costs and, you know, expectations of price changes and, you know, all of this type of thing. We're in a situation now where that's basically, it's like kind of like analogous to the yield curve, where it's been inverted, it's been turned on its head. It costs more to buy silver now than it does to buy it 6 months from now. And the reason that's the case is because we have a glaring shortage. And I went into this in more detail in last month's issue of the newsletter, and we probably don't have time to cover it all right now. But basically, we've got a huge shortage, and so we're seeing backwardation, and coin premiums are being affected, and there's a lot of areas of the silver market that are being affected right now because of this. And I'm going to tell you, you know, the mainstream press is going to blame this on, they're going to say, well, we have this vibrant economic recovery that's going on that's driving the demand for silver, and my counterpoint to that is, no, we have a couple vampire banks, namely J.P. Morgan and HSBC, that like to go short silver and concentrate their positions to try to control the market. People are getting angry. They're taking delivery, and it's backfiring on them.
Right.
So JP and HSBC kind of have, you know, their necks in the ringer here a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's my idea of a good time. They've been getting on over on us for how long? And having this come back on them a little bit, it's kind of funny to watch, really, when you think about it. But that's what's going on. That's the nickel version of what is going on in silver right now.
Well, it's still an excellent investment, is it not, for the future?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
Silver is an interesting metal because not only is it a monetary metal, it's also an industrial metal.
Right.
You know, you have all these gadgets out there. You know, you take a big screen TV. That has silver in the screen.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the stuff gets used. It gets used in biomedical applications, and that can't be recovered. You know, it's not like jewelry where it can be sent off to the smelter again and reused. You know, this silver is actually consumed.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the case with gold generally, by and large, I mean, yeah, we've got some of it floating in satellites and probably some sitting on the moon and, you know, space electronics and that kind of stuff. But for the most part, gold is not one of those things that's consumed at this point. So it's a little bit different in gold. The backwardation will probably take a little bit longer. It will come, and when it does, you're going to see the same thing happen in gold that happens with silver. It might be 14 on, you know, 1 month, and then 2 months later, it might be 2,700.
Wow. Well,
and that's going to be the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, Andy, let's. I'll leave the next.
Silver did. Silver was stuck between 17 and 19, and all of a sudden, it's 30.
Right, and now I think it's approaching an all-time high, isn't it? Not, it's over $30
an ounce.
Yeah,
silver. The all-time high for silver was around $50 back in '79 and '80.
Oh yeah, I mean that's when the Hunt brothers. I mean, but
involved.
More recently, wasn't the high in about $30 or $31 an ounce?
Right. Yeah, I mean we're at a multi-year, multi-decade.
Okay.
I was like $31.50 or something like that. Depending whether you were looking at spot or the, you know, the most recent dated contract. But yeah, we're definitely flirting with these multi-decade highs there, definitely.
Okay. Well, Andy, looks like we've run out of time. Let me leave you with the last minute so you can tell our listeners, our download listeners, you know, something about yourself and how they can reach you and about your newsletters, et cetera, however you want to deal with that. Why don't you go with that?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you having me back on here. If people want to find out more about what I do, they can give me a call, 888-633-5420. Again, 888-633-5420, or they can hit the website www.sutton-associates.net. Basically, what we do is we help people deal with these issues. You know, we talk about these things every month, and what I try to do is help people. You know, work with these issues. We work with you know, paper assets. We work with commodities. You know, I do economic research for people. So it really varies. There's a list on our website that shows the services that we do. I will say the next month's edition of our premium newsletter is going to be 100% totally dedicated to the issue of food and agribusiness.
Oh, you know, I want to discuss that. We'll have to discuss that next month then, okay?
Yeah, it's a huge theme. And I'm dispensing with all the other stuff, unless there's a big news event
Great. In
there somewhere. The whole issue is going to be dedicated to agribusiness, food, and some specific ideas
Wonderful.
Of how people can get exposure in that to temper themselves from you know, rising food prices. They're already going up. They're going to go up a lot more.
Right.
So we're going to deal with that totally in March's newsletter.
Okay.
So, again, if you want to get in touch with me, hit the website or feel free to give me a call.
Okay, Andy, thank you so much for being our guest. I always thoroughly enjoy it, and I hope you will accept our invitation to come back the third Wednesday of March.
Joe, appreciate it. Accepted, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
That's great. Thank you so much, Andy, and good night.
All right, have a good night. Bye now.
Oh, boy, I just love listening to Andy. He makes so much sense, and he knows what's going on. And this is Liberty Talk Radio, and what we're going to do now is go back and close our show. This is the end of today's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. Ranch Acres Audiology is a family hearing practice at 3227 East 31st Street in Tulsa. They may be reached at 918-749-7711. Call them for all your hearing needs. You will be glad that you did. Folks, you can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free. Liberated, your life is in your own hands, but with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal. The government hates competition." With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.